Welcome to the Owl Podcast. My name is Jameson, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry. Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm doing just well.
Good. And today we have a special guest. We have Alex with Time for Your Hobby on. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. We're thrilled to have you on. So I was on Alex's podcast a couple months ago, and what we were kind of doing is we wanted to have Alex on our show as well, so that way it was kind of, you know, we get a chance to talk about our podcast a little bit on his show, and he get a chance to talk a little bit about his podcast on our show. And yeah, we're excited to have you. But first things first, Alex, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name's Alex. I am 27 years old from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. This is like a Tinder date right now. You're knowing where I am. Yeah, you know, I like the color blue, long walks on roofs, not on the beach. I like to be a little different. I have a podcast, like Jameson said, about interviewing people about their hobbies. And yeah, I'm a fun guy, love to laugh, and, you know, the other Tinder stuff.
The other Tinder stuff.
But I am married, just so no Tinder for me.
Sounds good. So what made you decide to start a podcast?
So actually I used to produce music, so I had all the equipment. I used to record people in my basement, and my wife was working night shift, so I would come home, she'd be sleeping, and I was kind of bored where I had nothing to do, so I just sit there and be like, okay, I want to be productive. And then one friend decided, hey, I'm gonna start a podcast. And I said, I have the equipment, why not? I just had to try to figure out a theme or a subject to talk about. And literally, it just dawned on me out of nowhere. I'm like, hey, hobbies. I'm just going to interview people about their hobbies. And I didn't double question it. I just, you know what, went with that. And that's where I am today. Started back in September 2018. And yesterday, I just finished recording episode 51.
Dang. That's pretty impressive. You have how many out released right now then?
Currently, I have 40 release, but 51 recorded, and I have, I think, 10 episodes planned to be recorded this month. I try to limit myself to at least only 3 interviews per week, so I have enough time to edit.
Perfect. And then, random question here, then, what would you say is the most random hobby that you've encountered?
I don't know if it's random, but interesting. I have, I guess, 3. Okay. Well, they're all pretty crazy, but good. One of them is, I think it's episode 27, which is a guy who's from Macedonia. He is blind and plays board games.
I listened to that one, actually. That was a really good one. And you guys talked about playing, like, Secret Hitler and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I would love to give it a try, like, from his perspective, where it's just you have to listen to everything and just get a feel of it, which is crazy. And he also developed an application to help him with not necessarily reading cards, but more trying to, I forget the word, but trying to narrow down things. So like Secret Hitler, trying to figure out who the person is.
What's Secret Hitler? Is that like Marco Polo?
Secret Hitler.
Joel.
Oh, you found me.
Raise your hand if you hate Poland. I think that's him.
Yeah, but then after, one that I did not release yet, it's called Plogging. Or actually, did I release that? I can't even remember. Plogging, yeah, I did release that one, where you pick up trash while jogging.
That's a hobby?
That's a hobby, yeah.
There's a social media phenomenon where people are doing like Instagram videos, but cleaning up a street or something dirty. I know that's a phenomenon.
Interesting. Yeah. And I only learned about that after.
Yeah.
And the last one, but they're all interesting, but the last one, which I have not released yet, is something called urbexing.
I'm unfamiliar with what that is. Yeah.
So urbexing is when you go venturing in abandoned buildings.
Oh.
So he's from Scotland, and he's had some pretty creepy stories. You know what? I'm just going to give out one of the stories right now, even though the episode's not out yet. But so he's telling me him and his friend were visiting a building. And it was at night, and then they went down these staircases, and then they heard like a footstep, like slowly getting closer to them. They couldn't see anything, and like some growling or something like that, but it only sounded like 2 footsteps, so like a human or something. And then it stopped, and then it started running, but they still couldn't see it. So they ran back up the stairs, and as they're running back up the stairs, they hear like the most heart-clenching screech or like yell or something like that from this creature or human or whatever it was, and that just like gave me shivers when he told me that.
Jeez.
Yeah, just some guy on acid.
I probably would have pooped myself on that. That's terrifying.
And they still went back. That's the thing. I've said, you know what? Nope. If that was me, I would not go back.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Avoided danger once. Better not go back.
Yeah.
Where's that sound coming from?
But I get freaked out easily.
Okay. Where's that sound coming from? I better go closer to it. What's the worst that could happen?
Every horror movie ever.
Yeah. Let's split up.
Yeah, right? Awesome. So your podcast is about hobbies, and then I guess, did you have like a kind of like a thought process that you went through several different ideas where you're like, maybe I'll try this one first, maybe I'll do this one. And what made you finally settle on hobbies?
I've always wanted, so like for my podcast, I wanted to do something where it's not just me talking. It's more of an interview based process. Like I wanted to have the opinions of other people, see what they think. And there was a lot of podcasts of like people interviewing people about businesses, which I found very interesting. But I also know a lot of people who are very interesting but don't necessarily have businesses. Mm-hmm. And I feel like everybody has a hobby, or a majority of people do have hobbies, and they enjoy talking about it, and they can talk about it for days and days and days because there's something you're passionate about. So yeah, that was like how I settled on it. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to just try to get anybody and everybody to come on. Whoever doesn't have a voice at least has a voice to share on this podcast. And I try to do very little, well, maybe just a little bit, but not a lot of research on my guests, because I want to come at it as if I'm a listener as well. So it feels fresh. Mm-hmm. And of course, I have questions written down, but the additional questions I ask are genuine questions that I'm asking as if it was like a normal conversation. So let's say, Jameson, you said, oh, yeah, I know, I interviewed the Queen of England about punching walls. I would ask, what? Is she an angry person at heart that just loves punching walls? Is it any kind of walls? Is it like drywall, foam wall, jello wall? I don't know. But, and I'm sure these are questions that people who are listening would ask as well. So that was like my thought process when it came to hobbies, like an interactive thing.
I love it. And where do you meet most of the people that are on your podcast?
So for the first few episodes, I asked family and friends. So until I think like episode 16 or so is strictly family and friends. And then because I wanted to have at least some sort of base so I can show off to the internet, so people can be like, okay, this guy has this kind of stuff, yeah, I'm interested. So I've had people from Twitch, Instagram, but the majority of people where I actually found you as well was from Reddit.
Yeah, that makes sense. Huge community on Reddit.
Yeah
Reddit. Exactly. Yeah. They have a podcast. Who wants to be a guest? And they're like, oh, yeah, me. Cool. Yeah,
everybody.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So is there any goals that you have with your podcast then?
One goal that came maybe around episode 20 was that I want to try to get an interview from a person from every country in the world.
Ooh.
It's a big objective, but it's coming along so far. Like I had South Korea, Scotland, Macedonia, Colombia, Slovenia. But yeah, there's a lot of countries to go through. But other objective is try to get the message out there, try to share hobbies with people from around the world where they might not know about. And there's misconceptions. I want to get rid of those misconceptions and hopefully try to just unite people together and say, hey, we're all human. We're all trying to find happiness and hobbies. We share things in common.
Have you ever linked people up because of their hobbies? Like somebody listened to your episode and was like, wow, I really love doing that also. Let me get their information.
Yeah. Like that. It actually happens quite often where like I had a friend, like mostly I hear these from my friends because I stay in contact with them a lot more. Like I think it was episode 10, my friend's a butcher but also likes to cook meat, and then he got in contact with somebody who was a guest on my podcast a few episodes later, the aquarium girl. She listened to that podcast and they got in contact, and I had other guests ask questions, and then they follow each other on Instagram and stuff like that. So
nice.
Ideally I like that connection aspect.
Yeah.
Whether I'm involved or not, at least I'm like, someone made that happen. I'm like the Cupid of like hobbies.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Very cool. And do you have like any like, do you have a website? Do you have an email? Do you have, you know, your Instagram, things like that?
Yes, as a millennial, I have all of those. And the website, I believe, is Time for Your Hobby. Wait, let me just look it up. While I look it up, I'm going to say the other things. I'm on Instagram at Time for Your Hobby. And for my website, it is timeforyourhobby.wixsite.com/podcast. I know, I went with wix.com, like the free version, because nobody really listens on my website. So I have all the links to the other places you can listen to. So Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Overcast, yada, yada, yada. So basically, most platforms where you can find podcasts, I'm there. If I'm not there, just say, hey, Alex, why aren't you here? I said, oh, okay, let me go there so I can be there for you, kind of thing. So I try to get myself out there for everybody. What else? Email. Yes, of course. My email is timeforyourhobby@gmail.com. And if anybody would like to be a guest and talk about your hobby, of course, Greg, you as well, because I haven't had you yet. You're more than welcome to come on, and we can have a good long chat.
Perfect. And then the final question we have to have here is, what is Alex's hobby?
Are we talking about present Alex or growing up Alex?
Dealer's choice.
Okay, so let's go just a few years back. Not when I was born, but I used to play soccer a lot. I do that nowadays a little bit more. Well, a little bit less, but still today. And produce music, which I kind of took a pause from it because the podcasting has took a lot of time in my day. So I guess my hobby is other people's hobbies, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
And, I'm like Gollum, just consuming all the hobbies, like, my precious, yes, hobbies.
I need some.
Yeah.
So the other question I was going to ask you, and I just forgot it too. Oh, shoot. No, it wasn't more of a question. It was kind of more of a plug here once again. Our opening intro, you actually created. So we wanted to thank you for that. It's perfect. Yeah, it works perfect for our podcast. So we just wanted to thank you for that as well.
Well, I'm glad you like it. When I saw the title of Owl Podcast and I had that song in storage, I'm like, you know what? This one fits perfectly. So I just sent it to you, and I'm glad you use it. Every time I listen to your episode, I hear that. I'm like, oh, it's like when you see yourself like on the CTV cam or something like that in the store. Like, hey, that's me. That's me. It's like, yeah, you're smiling and nobody's looking. You're just smiling. You're like, yeah, I know, but it's me.
Yeah, I did that. That's mine.
So, yeah.
So yeah, we really appreciate that. And then do you have like anything that you use to plug your music or anything like that? As far as, do you have like a website for that or no?
Yeah, I've been doing it for 10 years. I haven't used SoundCloud, well, a little bit, but I mostly put everything on YouTube, and my name on there is Soulogical Music, all one word. So you have a variety of music there, hip-hop, classical music, scores, so like in movies, those epic trailer movies, mm-hmm. Me rapping, me trying to sing, not that great, other people singing with me or rapping with me. So it's me just trying out a bunch of different things. So every now and then I might upload a new song or instrumental, but it's slowed down significantly these days because of podcasting. But I'll chime in every now and then to just show, hey, Alex is still somewhat creative. He's not just stealing everybody's creativity for his podcast, you know.
Sure. And what was the name of your YouTube channel one more time?
The YouTube channel is called Soulogical Music.
Soulogical Music. Awesome. I'll check it out. Yeah, because
okay,
your intro, it was just fantastic. So, I mean, if I like that, I'm sure I'm going to like all your other stuff. So,
I'm knocking on wood. I hope you do.
Fair enough.
If you don't, I'll just delete that and say it never happened.
Fair. We'll just pretend like it never happened. There you go.
Yeah.
Cool. Jerry, do you have any more questions or...
No more questions.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll dive in today for our podcast topic here. And what we decided a couple weeks ago is we thought it'd be a good idea to just kind of get somebody on here and we'll talk about their most controversial opinions. So it can be whatever. You know, this particular one here, if you have something that's always been on your mind and you thought it was a bit of a controversial podcast, or not podcast, but opinion, now's your time to basically talk about it. So, Jerry, I figured we can go ahead and start with you. I'll let you kind of just take the wheel and run with it. So,
Yeah. Speaking of Hitler,
whoa, we're diving right in. Okay.
Yeah. He had some good. No. but I guess it does kind of lead to that road. I have a few controversial topics. One, I guess I'll stick with two. One is vaccination. One, I think vaccines should be mandatory. I have a lot of reasons why I think they should be mandatory. One, my degree, I don't know if listeners know, but my degree was a Bachelor of Science in Microbiology. So I've studied immunology and vaccines pretty extensively. So that's what my background is. So I'm pretty opinionated on vaccines. So I think that would be a very controversial one. And then the other controversial one, we don't have to get too much into it, but I think the two kind of merge with each other, or sort of kind of Venn diagram over each other, is eugenics. And I know that word raises a lot of red flags, but I think it would be an interesting conversation to see what people think eugenics is, because when you usually think of eugenics, you think of like a race purity or something like that, right? But really, eugenics was just a kind of a movement, off the cuff thing, where it's like what I'm thinking about when I say eugenics is something like a terminal disease for the child, or some kind of horrible disease that we know the child has to go through, that would we rather the child not go through that versus, you know, what the alternative to that is. So I'll let you guys kind of respond to that. I know they're heavy topics, but I'll let you respond to either one of those.
Yeah, well, to start off with the first one, I actually studied international development and globalization back in university. So the idea of vaccination came up quite often, because disease in, let's say, third world countries are pretty present. And that was something that we talked about a lot throughout my 4 years of university. And of course, yeah, I fully support vaccination. I don't understand why it would be something to debate. Like, these are studies, these are things that they've been tested multiple times, and it's been proven throughout history that vaccinations have been a good thing. Just going with the idea of, oh yeah, yeah, just what doesn't kill you makes it stronger, isn't necessarily a true thing. It's like saying a bullet to the head, yeah, if it doesn't kill you makes you stronger, like sure, you can survive, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're gonna be stronger. But the idea that vaccinations, sure, there are some cases that it does have an impact on certain people, but that's for everything. Like, you take any type of medication or anything like that, it will have a different effect on every single person, but the majority of them will, let's say, be for the majority, in the sense that they've studied, so it works on the majority. Nothing is 100% foolproof, but they're pretty damn close.
True.
Yeah, I would agree. I let me see. I don't think anybody. Well, there's two topics. One is the anti-vaxxer movement, which I don't know. I don't think any of us lean towards it, but I'd be happy to discuss it in case anybody does. And then the other one is, you know, mandatory vaccinations, which is the government imposing vaccines on people, which I think is a little more controversial, and people would have a harder time understanding.
So Jerry,
go ahead.
I was gonna say, so Jerry, I guess, what would you say is your take on it that makes it controversial? So,
well, I don't. Well, one, I mean, there's the argument that you don't want the. So, for example, religious belief. If you're religious and you're convinced that vaccines, let's just throw up something random, right, will inject you with the devil or some kind of alien species, right? It's liberty to abstain from that, right? The government shouldn't impose itself upon you and your body. So it'd be controversial, because the government is saying, well, regardless of your religious belief, regardless of your, you know, personal opinion, right, you have to get yourself medicated because it's for the good of the community. So you can make that leap, that kind of Orwellian leap, to say, well, if the government is imposing themselves and injecting people, you know, where can't they stop? So that's where I can see it being controversial.
Okay. So what you're talking about is almost to an extent of, like, with the argument of religion, that would violate people's, you know, First Amendment rights, essentially, if they say that they're doing this for religious purposes and they have the freedom of religion, but the government's mandating that they need to do this. you could argue that that's essentially a violation of their constitutional rights.
Exactly, but it's one of the few examples that I can think of that it kind of requires violating people's, even their own, you know, you have to get this vaccination because that's how vaccines work. It doesn't matter if one or two people have it. It basically requires herd immunity or the vaccine isn't effective. So it's one of the few things that I can think of that really the government has to impose itself on people and take away what we would consider their personal opinions, right, or infringing on their civil liberties, because we do need everybody to be vaccinated. Because there are, as Alex was saying, there are people that react negatively to a vaccine, and some people can't get vaccinated. Some people, like infants, can't get vaccinated. So you're putting people needlessly at risk just because of your personal beliefs.
So are you arguing the greater good in this specific instance overlaps, but is more prevalent than actually having somebody's constitutional rights?
Well, I would argue that vaccines should be mandatory, and we should at the very least not allow people's personal liberties and personal opinions to infringe on that. We should make vaccines mandatory because the science is there. There's very few legitimate reasons why people shouldn't get vaccinated.
And to add on to that point as well, with vaccinations and shots and drugs these days, if you are allergic to something, there's sometimes alternatives. So if you're allergic to morphine, maybe you can use Valium. So there's always an alternative for people who have different reactions. That's why when you have a doctor, go see a doctor, they want to make sure if you're allergic to anything, and there's different alternatives. I'm not quite familiar with vaccines, how many alternatives there are, but I would imagine that'd be something that they would develop because different body reactions. And just to go back on the point I said before about getting shot in the head and walking away from it, let's say the arm instead, because, you know, that's a little dark for the head and stuff like that. But yeah, so just wanted to prove that point, not for your listeners to think, is Alex really thinking that people go away from a shot from the head?
No, I don't think he's that naive, but...
But I mean, the senator, or the, was she a House of Representatives lady, Kathy Gifford? She got shot in the head. She walked away from it. But yeah, so I take your point.
So,
And so you're saying she could rap now?
Yeah.
Exactly what we're saying. So Jerry, the only question I would ask you then, and I'm actually very, you know, pro vaccination, so I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate here. To bring it back around to that whole religious aspect, you know, the greater good, but the violation of people's constitutional rights, I guess, where then do the government draw the line?
I think, like with everything, we have to use science and reason and logic to prove why we should, or to explain why we should do certain things. There are vaccines that don't have 100% efficacy, or, you know, that aren't necessary for people to take, and it behooves or falls on the government and our government officials to explain to the public why we're vaccinating and what vaccine we're using. So the MMR vaccine, right? Everybody got it. You got it as a kid, right? It's 100% efficacy, or almost up to 99.9. Everybody has to get it, and it's easy to explain why it would be mandatory. But there are other vaccines, malaria vaccine that we're working on, right, aren't at 100% efficacy. They're about 70-80%, last I read, and it's not necessary. So it's not like I'm advocating for the government to just, you know, right, puncture you with every needle they can find. I'm saying that we need to be reasonable and use science as our best tool and explain to people why we're vaccinating them and why their kids have to be vaccinated.
See, I completely agree with you. And from looking from the other perspective of other people, why I'm not agree with people who are anti-vax, but I'm seeing where they're coming from, in the sense that the internet, no matter how great it is, people will end up finding an answer for whatever they believe in. So for anti-vaxxers, if they think, oh, this is not good for my child, they're going to look on the internet. They'll find a million articles and research papers saying you should vaccinate your children, and then they'll find that one article saying don't vaccinate your children for this reason, and then they're going to keep going on that point, which it's kind of crazy to think that the internet could be so useful but so detrimental and dangerous at the same time.
Yeah.
The one person who learns about it will share it to the other person and vice versa. And through down the line, there's a loss of communication. It's like playing the telephone game. So you tell one person one thing, and then the story gets modified to the next person and to the next person and to the next person. So like you get people saying, oh, well, I heard if you get this vaccination, they'll have to amputate your leg 10 years later. What? Like the story gets so ridiculous. And that's why it's a thin line. Like, do you want the government to be more transparent? But even when they're more transparent, will people believe it? It's a matter of trust, right?
Yeah, and it's so easy to manipulate people. And vaccines are difficult to understand. It's just, what do you mean you're going to inject me with this little protein and all of a sudden I'm going to be resistant or immune to that disease? That doesn't make sense. And people don't understand it. And it's so easy to tell people, and especially parents, hey, there's all these weird chemicals in that vaccine. Don't put them in your children, right? And it's very difficult for people to understand the actual science and the mechanism behind these vaccines. So yeah, I totally agree with you. The internet can be used very perniciously. It can bring about a lot of misinformation. And it's just, I think that the people on the side of scientific awareness or you know, scientific advocates are failing ultimately. I think we're not playing the PR campaign as well as we could be. Right? Mm-hmm. We need to be out there and advocating as much to be able to have uncomfortable conversations with people. I guess this podcast up, but yeah, I think we could do a better job.
Well, you know what's crazy? It's on top of the internet, it's the articles. I'm not bashing all journalists, but you know how they say sex sells, violence sells, or stuff like that? You don't want to hear stories of like, oh yeah, they found the cure for something. It's the stories like, this vaccine causes autism.
Yeah.
Those big headline is breaking news. Like, I don't know about you guys, but as I get older, I watch news, doesn't matter where it's from. I just feel, wow, it's not as useful as I thought it would be. Like as a kid, I'm like, oh, the news. Yeah. You listen to that. That's the truth. But as you grow up, you're like, they're just trying to race to be the first one out there, regardless of being right or wrong.
Their TV show trying to get ratings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How is the biggest headline, your kid won't get measles? Like, how is that not a huge headline? That should be, hey, here's a list of things your kid won't get. Mumps, hey,
your kid measles, won't die because of this.
Rubella. Yeah. Have you seen anybody with smallpox recently? No.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You know what's crazy? We seem to be living in this time where we're only able to handle one big disease at a time, and then it just magically disappears. Swine flu. It was big. Yeah. Everybody's getting it. Disappears. Mad cow disease. Big. Disappeared. Ebola. Big. Like, when's the last time you heard about Ebola?
Yeah, it's a good
point.
It
just magically disappeared. But of course it didn't.
Well, there's going to be one-time Black Death shows right back up, and we're all going to be burned.
Yeah. We're going to look like fools.
Exactly.
Hopefully it passes, but that was my controversial thing. I knew people are going to... Really, parents, it's very difficult to trust, especially knowing how incompetent yet things. It's very difficult as a parent to know who to trust, right? Do you trust the government source, or do you trust this doctor who's advocating against vaccines because he knows the secret? And you know, it's just I definitely sympathize and empathize with parents, because you have to make a decision about your child's future, and there's most parents, like 99% of parents, have their child's best interests at heart. So it can be difficult for them to trust governments.
And Jerry, what was that other topic you brought up that you said that you have a controversial opinion on?
Well, this, like I said, this kind of Venn diagrams or segues or melds together is the concept of eugenics. This was... I guess popularized in the 1920s, probably earlier, but this was the selection of people the artificial selection of people, kind of like we do with animals or dogs. And obviously this can go horribly wrong, like Hitler, like we mentioned earlier. This can spew into concepts of racial superiority, all these things, right? So it can go off or it can go in a horrible way pretty quickly. What I was trying to get at, or what I heard on a recent podcast with Sam Harrison, a doctor that he had on, talking about cancer or eugenics, where we actively select, because we can run tests on fetuses now to see whether this fetus is vulnerable to, you know, horrible debilitating or incapacitating diseases, right? You can have a child born with some kind of disfigurement or some kind of disease that's going to cripple them at birth. So this lands, for some reason, lands in within that purview of eugenics. So I would argue that we should take a hard look at fetuses, and if the fetus is vulnerable or has, you know, a very good probability of being born with some kind of horrible crippling disease, then we should look at or potentially aborting that fetus, or not, you know, letting the child suffer through that.
You know what? I agree. Yeah, but at the same time, whereas the eugenics aspect, we're not just necessarily, because at the same time, we're also talking about people trying to change the color of the eye of the baby and the hair. So it's like, is that right? I personally, I don't think that's right. Like, I think that aspect, it should just let it up to be genetics and let that be decided. But the disease aspect, I completely agree that there's certain things that if you have the possibility to make the life better for your child or reduce the suffering, do what you need to do. And if, yeah, it's very controversial, I can see, because I think one of your states, it just, I can't remember which one.
Probably Alabama. It was more like,
yeah, Alabama with the whole abortion thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, so I'm up in Canada, so I'm watching this from the top view, so of course I'm just looking at it, non-judgmental, I'm just listening to this, gathering information. But it's interesting to just to see different perspectives of everybody. But let's say, so, yeah, let's say if it was my child and it was going through a situation like this, I would do everything I can to make their life a lot better.
Yeah, and I was trying to sugarcoat it a little bit with the diseases, because I feel like diseases is a lot easier. But yeah, once you get into designer babies, that's where it can get really controversial, because, and then it can even get more controversial when you include, you know, behavioral aspects into genetics, right, where you can raise their intelligence, or you can make your kid the next Usain Bolt or Olympic athlete, right? It's once you really start getting into designer babies, that's where it gets even more controversial.
What was that recent discovery? I think it's called like Crisco or they're just talking.
It's called CRISPR.
CRISPR
is a defense mechanisms that we found within bacteria. Bacteria have a defense mechanism against their own viruses. Viruses are orders of magnitude smaller than bacteria. And what we found was that bacteria could actually bat out or snip out the virus's DNA or RNA whenever they were inserted into bacteria. So really, really clever doctors out of California figured out that bacteria have this ancient defense mechanism, and they manipulated it. So now we can edit genetics, you know, very precisely, right, by the codon, by the letter. So it's really useful if you're trying to change genetics.
Now, I'm not an expert, but from my, not experience, but I've heard that bacteria always find a way, and sometimes they build immunity and resistance. Is that something that's like they look
after? Yeah, I mean, bacteria are incredibly resilient. They'll always, there's no matter how good your unless you just burn it all, but and even then, but no matter how good your antibacteria is, right, your antibacterial drug, they're pretty good at adapting in within a generation or two of those bacteria, right? So they'll either pump out the antibacterial, they'll go into kind of a dormant state to where they're not really changing. It's amazing how resilient bacteria are.
So it's just like a constant race, like the bacteria is ahead and you just got to catch up.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's why we've had so many different antibacterial drugs, and almost why we're running out of them.
It's like Jeff Goldblum says, life finds a way.
yeah, it does.
So, all right. Well,
JMO, what do you think about the designer babies and eugenics?
So,
what kind of? What color eyes do you want your child to have?
Well, first off,
a rainbow, just all the colors. You can switch. Yeah, yeah. There's a little right, knob beside exactly the eyes. You can switch.
I'd like my child to be Mystique from X-Men, so that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
No, when it comes to the designer baby aspect of things, obviously I'm very anti-designer baby. I mean, my family, we have several people in our family that we've adopted throughout the years that are Down syndrome. So I think Down syndrome people are incredible people in that, I mean, I think that they have a lot to teach us and a lot to, you know, offer society and things like that as well, especially in the name of science too. I mean, they're different things with their chromosomes that I think can even teach people, you know, to battle things like Alzheimer's and stuff like that as well. But when it, and so that kind of bums, and so what I guess I should say is when I hear about the eugenics, especially when it comes to like the babies, the designer babies, things like that, I read a story a few months ago that kind of bummed me out, and I brought this up on one of our podcasts a while back, but it was a couple that was intentionally trying to have a baby, and then when they found out that the baby was going to be Down syndrome, they ended up aborting the baby. And I was pretty bummed about that, but it kind of falls into that eugenics aspects where you're talking about like, well, this child's going to be born with Down syndrome, so is it really a life that's worth living? No, maybe we should look at aborting the baby. And I just don't think that that's necessarily right. Now, obviously, if you're finding something like this baby's going to be born and it's going to have leukemia within the first year and it's going to be dead by the age of like 4, that's not a life worth living. And I could see the argument for that, but when it just feels like it's a very slippery slope, and I feel like a lot of people would like to essentially use eugenics essentially as kind of almost an out or an escape to just, like you said, get right into the designer babies. And I don't see where people would look at drawing the line with it, unless it's almost like you'd have to put like the most extreme circumstances together. Like I said, like that baby that's going to be born and have leukemia and die within the first, you know, like 4 years of its life. So,
but is it,
go ahead.
Or sorry to interrupt, but is it, I don't think it's, so I vary a little bit. I don't think it's crazy if we know, let's say we find a gene that correlates or corresponds to intelligence, right? Why would it be so crazy for a parent to want their child to have the best possible outcome in life? So if you know that you insert gene 5 into this baby's chromosome or DNA, that its intelligence is going to be in the upper percentile and it's going to have a really good chance at being successful in life, like, why is that? If you can pay for it, I don't understand why that is so crazy. I mean, I can see why, but...
Well, yeah, this, you can see this. This is talking about not necessarily personal experience. So my wife is South Korean. Uh-huh. And the Korean culture, they're very hardworking. And it's a very stressful environment. And there's a lot of smart people. So it comes to the question, just because somebody's... this in my opinion, if just because you're intelligent doesn't necessarily mean you're going to find happiness.
True.
So there's like some people, you want to make your kid intelligent. You want to make him the best athlete. But... is this something that they want later on or they want to apply in life? Because like I had a conversation with somebody who has their PhD and was a biologist, but then decided, you know what, I'm just going to become a YouTube creator. Just out of the blue, she was not interested in that anymore. So she was very smart, but just wasn't interested. So it's kind of, I get it, but don't get it at the same time, because you try to want the best, but you don't necessarily know what that kid wants. You know what I mean?
And it seems like it's also an argument of free will to an extent too, which I know Jerry and I have talked about, in that, you know, I believe more in free will than maybe Jerry does to an extent, but I feel like that definitely affects the kid's free will as well, kind of like what Alex was talking about there, to really affect what they want with their own lives. Yes, you're trying to give them the best fighting chance, but at the same time, everybody else has had the same playing field for years, so why should we start altering it now, and why should we start thinking that we know what's best for human evolution?
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think we should mess with it too much, but mostly to play devil's advocate, and also because I do empathize with parents, and I do sympathize. I mean, parents work really hard, and even people themselves, but parents work really hard to put their kids in a successful position. If you knew, like, with a good degree of certainty, mm-hmm. that if you change their genetics, they're going to be, they have a chance of being more successful. It's like raising them in a good home or raising them mm-hmm. in a good neighborhood, right? It's like, okay, well, people that are successful typically tend to come from, you know, neighborhoods that are well off and affluent, right? There's very few successful people that are making it out of the ghettos. Again, I feel like it's the same thing. So I would sympathize with parents and empathize with them, be like, okay, well, yeah, I can see why you would want your child to have the quote unquote intelligence gene, or right, the super athlete gene or something like that, right? So I'm not saying I agree with it, but I'm saying I would understand why parents would want to do with it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. Sorry for interrupting. On that note, what's your thoughts on cloning? Because remember, they tried to clone Dolly the sheep.
Yeah.
Because it seems like almost in the same area of like, should we do it or should we not do it? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't have any inherent reservations or I'm not against it or anything, but I just. I guess we're never going to get to a point, or I don't see in the foreseeable future getting to a point where cloning somebody is going to be like exactly like the other person, right? It's just human minds are so malleable and complicated.
Nurture aspect as well.
Yeah, it's just it's going to be so. Yeah, it's going to be so difficult to get the exact same person.
It's kind of like twins. Right until,
yeah, exactly, like identical twins that share. The most, I mean, they're as identical as they can get, right? And it's just, but I'm not creeped out by it or anything. I mean, it's just, I understand genetics and I understand how people are made. So it just, it doesn't, I don't have any inherent reservations towards it. And if I was a clone, I thought that would be pretty cool.
Wow. The question would be, would you get annoyed by yourself?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you attack yourself, you, Jason, I consider it assault. I don't know. you know, I see that there could be beneficial aspects to cloning in certain ways. Like maybe, you know, if you clone your or like organs, things like that. You know, so for example, you get in a car accident and, you know, you have all of a sudden a punctured kidney and damaged liver and punctured lung, things like that. But if you happen to just have, you know, a spare lung, spare kidney, and a spare liver in the cooler back there that you would have, that's perfect match for you, that could be a life-saving technology at that point. But if we're starting to look at, like, you know, oh, Albert Einstein was such a great innovative thinker, we need more Albert Einsteins, let's keep you know, making more and more of him, I'm like, well, there was one and he was great for a reason. Do we really need more? I don't know. I mean, do we, or should we be looking for the next Albert Einstein? So that's kind of my thought, that there's, it's a double-edged sword.
You know what? Yeah, it is very double-edged. And I personally, I like the idea of like the disease and preventing like, say, life-threatening things for unborn babies. Mm-hmm. But the idea of like making them super intelligent, and let's say, theoretically speaking, if everybody on Earth did that, will human evolution move forward after that, or will we be stuck at this plateau that everybody's at the same and there's no more of trying to be better than the other person because everybody will have the exact same mindset and like same speed, no world records would be broken anymore, or
no more creativity,
everybody's painting the exact same thing.
It's crazy. I never really thought too much about clone or being cloned, so it's kind of a,
but I did like the organ idea. That's pretty good. I didn't think of that either.
That was that. I don't know. That was the first thing that popped in my mind. Like, you know, because obviously people on transplant lists for, you know, hearts or other different organs, things like that, sometimes you have to end up, you know, waiting out their lives and not get an extra organ, and they die when they're in their like their 40s or their 50s or something like that. But if you were able to, essentially, you have, you know, a backup heart or a backup, you know, lung or something like that that you could use, I mean, it'd be great. I mean, because you'd have a perfect match every time.
Well, on that note, you know how everything nowadays, we're all doing the DNA test and people can determine they're prone to certain disease? I feel like we're on that line where we're learning more about problems that humans may have and getting all this data. What's your take on the whole learning about your ancestry and knowing what kind of diseases you may get later on?
So for me personally, you know, like my parents, you know, they raised me and they had me biologically and stuff like that. So I was cool with learning about, you know, the 23andMe and finding out my history. And then, of course, you know, finding out a little bit more about my family history as well, things that were prone to, stuff like that. I mean, I found out I actually have a rare blood disease that my mom gave me, but it's nothing really like life-threatening. It's just something that's very rare that doesn't tend to occur a lot, which I thought was actually pretty fascinating. And then, but like my friend Matt, he was adopted and he considers his parents his birth parents. And he has no interest in finding out anything about his actual biological parents. So he has no interest in doing anything like the 23andMe, anything like that, because he feels like it would be kind of a slap to his face to the parents that raised him. So I could see, you know, for why some people wouldn't want to do that. But for me personally, I would want to see what diseases I'm prone to, or, you know, like what different things, or just kind of my history, because I'm a history nerd, so I love history, and I would love to find out more about my family history as well. I'll be like, oh, cool, I have family that originated from this part of Africa and this part of Europe and this part of Asia. That's awesome. So personally, I think it'd be pretty cool. What about you?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I, like Jameson said, I'm a huge history nerd. I took that 23andMe and I found out I was all sorts of interesting thing. I found out I was like 1% Jewish Ashkenazi Jew, which I would never would have guessed. Mostly from Spain. I didn't find out any rare genetic disorders. I'm pretty much a mutt. But yeah, I thought super interesting. I'd love to know more.
I also did it as well. I did the ancestry one, but I didn't do like the whole disease. I just did the where are you from? And basically it's half Europe, like Europe and then Africa, Europe and then Africa and then Caribbean and then Canada. So I'm just a mutt here. I'm like, oh yeah, you're like 1% this, 1% that. Like I have it in front of me right now. I'm just going to go at the bottom one. It's like, you're 1% Togo, you're 1% Ireland, you're 1% Cote d'Ivoire, you're 1% this. And I'm like, you're 15% Benin Togo. I'm like, all right, cool. So, but other than that, I don't know. I opt out of the decision to do the whole disease thing. My sister did it with 23andMe, but I don't know. For me personally, I'm like, you know what? I just want to live life. I'm not scared of not knowing, or I'm not scared of knowing it. It just didn't occur to me.
Yeah. I mean, and for some people, I think it's important that, you know, like I said, this is kind of where the double-edged sword comes in with, for somebody like my buddy Matt, who is adopted and views his family as his birth family and stuff like that, and views it kind of be like a slap to the face to find out anything more about his actual biological family. I mean, if I was in his shoes, though, I would want to know, to be like, am I prone to strokes? Am I prone to heart attacks? Am I prone to diabetes? Anything like that, you know? So, I mean, that, me personally, I would really want to know that kind of stuff if I was in his shoes, but I could also understand why he feels like it might be a slap to their face, so.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It's too bad you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, anyway, I think we've kind of covered Jerry's topics. Alex, why don't you tell us about yours?
So, yeah, I have a bunch of topics, but let's see. A
couple of your favorite. Ooh,
couple of my favorite. You know what? It has to be with college and university professors.
Okay.
One of my biggest issues is that, maybe not for colleges, because I know in the U.S., it may be different than Canada when it comes to colleges and university, but you can tell if you've been, if you have this experience. But I realize some professors in university in Canada, they know their material, but they cannot teach it. They cannot share it with their students. They think they're all high and mighty, and they think that you have to understand what they understand. And then if you don't understand what they understand, then you're stupid, kind of thing. I have two examples of this. I've had one professor, I think he was from Rwanda, short guy, and he would say stuff like, I'm a professor, I can't be racist. I'm like, okay. And he would say other stuff like, she was wearing a hijab, but she was smart. I'm like, what? And then the last one is like, no A-pluses are, A-pluses don't exist in my class. But actually, a year after, I met him in the elevator, and he was looking at me, and I was looking at him, and I'm like, do I recognize him? And then he looks back, little angry guy just looking at me. And then he turns to me, he's like, you could have said hello. I'm like, well, you could have said hello to me too. He's like, I'm old, I have problems. I'm like, well, damn, I got problems too. Don't make yourself unique. Jeez. And then he just like walked out the elevator.
Thinks pretty highly of himself, doesn't he?
Yeah, oh yeah. And the other professor. So I'm dyslexic. So I have a reading disability and a writing disability. So that's why I talk a lot. That's why I try to cover it up. But I've had this professor where he pulled me to the side one time and he's like, I've noticed your writing is a little different, how you write. I'm like, oh yeah, that could be because of my dyslexia, this is just the way I think. And then he's like, oh well, you can cure that by reading more. And the fact that I'm like, you know what, he's got my grades in his hands, I'm just like, oh okay. And he goes on to say, well, my son has ADHD, And he cured that by reading. I'm like, oh. But in my mind, I'm like, that's not how it works. But you know what? You got my grades. I'm not going to try to mess with you right now. But the moment I'm not in your class anymore and you bring that up, I'm going to shut you down because that's stupid.
Yeah. So I guess, are you saying, like, when they can't teach their subject, do you think that, I guess, what do you think that they should do in order to improve that then?
Well, it's like, I think like high school teachers, they learn how to teach the material to their students. But for university professors, some of them are not taught how to teach. They just graduated or have their master's or PhD in their field and then just go on to just not even share. They're doing it sometimes for their own research. And they don't necessarily transmit the information well, and it's a lost communication, and it doesn't build the future. And I've seen a lot of students, like, they complain about certain things because the professors do not know how to teach. Don't get me wrong, I've had many good professors as well. And then you get the one bad egg, and it's unfortunate. That's all I'm saying, that they should probably, I think they talked about it for Canada at least, trying to implement a system to teach professors and how to deliver material and how people learn in different ways.
So it almost sounds like, you know, these professors, a lot of the times they're only hired because they are experts in their field. But, you know, like a lot of the teachers that, you know, teach at the high school, the elementary level, things like that, they actually have to take specific classes in essentially becoming educators. You think that this needs to be something mandatory for the professors as well? Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's my thought, because I have friends who are trained to be teachers and they're working really hard and they get in-field experience, like say, I wouldn't say an internship, but the same practice where they go into classes from different levels to try to understand how to communicate information, how to transmit it, and also understand students, because in university, you're a sheep. At least for the first 2 years, you're a sheep, and that's the only way they see you. If you don't care about your grade, they won't care about it, and that's fair. That teaches you to be responsible and realize that, okay, I have to take responsibilities. And it's also kind of crazy to think that in grade 12, you have to raise your hand to go to the washroom, and then the following year, you have to make decisions that will have an impact on the rest of your life, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a big jump.
It's just amazing that we have institutions dedicated to learning and each teacher is eclectic and has their own way. We don't even have a science of teaching. Like, we don't really have uniformity in it. It's just every professor that I've had was different, and some of them were terrible, and you just looked at a PowerPoint for an hour. Mm-hmm. And then other professors were great, and you actually learned something, and I still remember those classes. But yeah, I would totally agree. Teachers should never be put on a pedestal, or should never feel like they're on a pedestal. Learning is an all-inclusive experience, and if you're especially at a university, everybody's there because they're curious and they want to learn something, and teachers have a responsibility to their students and to never feel above them or feel like they're the all-powerful all-knowers, right? It's people that know or read a little bit or have a little bit of knowledge. It's those people that are aware of how little you actually know once you take a step towards knowledge. So yeah, I totally agree. Teachers should never be put on a pedestal.
Yeah, and because also teachers can learn things from students as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Or a new way of thinking about things, that it just people are gonna word. It's amazing how the same subject can be reworded over and over, and because every person is unique, right? It's just they're going to word it in their particular way.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys learned this in high school, but I feel like the education system is pretty outdated. Like, one thing I feel like they don't really teach is how to do your taxes.
Yes.
Like, whether you go to university or you don't, or college, you still have to learn how to do taxes, and they don't teach you that in high school. Well, at least from my high school and from my other friends, but I feel like it needs to be updated.
No, I agree. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that I feel like they push on you as students, like, you'll need to know this, you'll need to know. I remember one thing when I was in elementary and high school that they would say to us constantly is, like, you'll need to know this because you won't have a calculator and you won't have, like, a dictionary and things like that in the palm of your hand. And now look at 2019, everybody's got one in their pocket, you know, so you're right, they definitely need to update things. And, you know, there's so many different skills that I feel like I've learned since I graduated high school to, you know, being now in my 30s, that are so much more useful that if they taught mm-hmm. me that when I was in, you know, middle school or junior high or in high school or anything like that, that if they're like, hey, you know, here's how to do your taxes. Hey, you know, here's how to fill out a W-2 for, you know, here's how to fill out an application. Here's how to, you know, actually have a good job interview, things like that, that probably would have been much more beneficial than me trying to learn the different integers and things like that, that I'm never really going to use. So I'm like, okay, you know, like,
you don't need to learn about your taxes. Let's do some algebra.
Exactly. I'm like, cool. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. You know, but there's just so many. And then the other thing that I would argue as well is that they need to look at bringing back a lot of different trade skills, because, you know, mm-hmm. somebody in my profession, I do property management, and I had to, over the course of the years that I've been doing this, learn a lot of different trade skills, you know, things like plumbing, welding, HVAC repairs, things of that nature, that nothing like that was taught to me in high school or junior high. That if they had classes like that during those specific, you know, time frames of the year, I could have done what I'm doing now and actually go to a trade school to learn these different things and know that that's something I would have enjoyed doing, you know, in my early 20s versus now in my early 30s. So, yeah.
You know what's crazy is that the older we get and the more technology we get, the more dependent we become on it. Because I remember reading a story where, so back in the days, gas stations used to have people that would pump gas into your car.
Right.
And they slowly got rid of that, and there's certain places where they went to the gas station and they did not know how to put gas in their own car.
Yeah, I remember there was like a big thing in Oregon about that, because in Oregon was one of the few states that they still had people come out and pump your gas for you, and then like overnight they stopped doing that, and people were exactly like what you just said, kind of just staring at the pump like, what do I do, I'm gonna freak out, you know? So yeah, but anyway,
yeah.
Any more thoughts on that, Jerry, about kind of the whole, like, some different skills and things like that that should have been taught in the younger years?
No, I mean, I totally agree. I think I could have used less trigonometry and a little more basic life skills, how to be an adult.
How to, you know, create a finance and, like, stick with a monthly budget type thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I could have.
Yeah, how do you manage your money? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that would have been a huge thing for students to learn in their early years, you know, to learn how to write in a checkbook for, you know, before there was actual online banking. So
yep, I completely agree.
Anyway, do you have another one that you wanted to share?
Let's see, I do. Oh, like, sure, this is like more of a philosophy one. Like two things. So I think it was forget the philosopher's name, but the quote was, people are good by nature, but corrupted by society. So I kind of have, I wouldn't necessarily say I have an issue with social media, but I don't necessarily like the turn or the way it's turning into, like, where it's turning people into this mob mentality, where we, like, sometimes we hear one little thing about somebody and we automatically jump the gun. Like, oh, this person was a bad aunt. Oh, why? She's a bad aunt. I don't need all the information, but I'm going to get angry. And if you were to just sit one, like a one-on-one conversation, you get down to the solution and you actually get to understand the perspective. There was a story where apparently an aunt sued, like the headline was, the aunt, worst aunt ever. She sued her nephew for giving her a hug. But basically the story, what happened is what the son or the nephew ran into the aunt and broke a bone. And in order to pay for the recovery, the smartest process was to go through the insurance company, and they just had to put somebody at fault on the name or on the policy. So they put the nephew, but it wasn't going to do anything big. It was just so they have a name, and the media blew it out of proportion, and the social media, and it actually ruined this person's life because he couldn't find a job because her name was tarnished. And that's like a controversial thing where I think social media is good, but it could also be bad at the same time. That's my controversial thing that's bothering me.
Well, and it's kind of turning into the whole thing, like, the internet never forgets either, because anything now that happens, kind of like what you were just saying, or anything that you post online, anything like that, it's now out there forever. It's never going to go away either. So the social media is never going to forget what you're saying, you know? So it's
yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And what scares me is that people just splew out whatever's on their mind as if it's like their significant other or family member. They will just say whatever they're on their mind and not really going through the thought process of what they're putting out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cushions later on in life.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, just a couple of things. I would mostly agree with the quote. I do think people are generally good in nature. I don't know if society necessarily corrupts them, but I think it's just the situations that they face. But, and then just as far as social media, I actually did read that story. I forget where I read it, but it was amazing just how many people ruined this person's life because they didn't bother to read it, and they just, it was basically just clickbait, and they just read a headline. And then I guess tying into the social media thing, what do you guys think is a good amount? So let's say somebody did something wrong. What is a good amount of time for that person to be kind of excoriated from our society, or to be before they're allowed back in? So somebody like a Louis C.K., right, that had those allegations against him. What's a good amount of time for him to sort of be in society jail before we allow him back into the mix?
I would say that would argue on the severity of the crime, because if you're talking about someone like Louis C.K. versus maybe somebody like Bill Cosby, I would argue that, you know, I don't think somebody like Bill Cosby should probably be given a second chance versus Louis C.K. What, he just jerked off in front of a couple of girls and made them watch? I mean, granted, that's pretty shallow and pretty gross of him to do, but I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. But
so should we kick people out of society like Roseanne Barr, that was a comedian, right? She said something stupid and racist on Twitter. How long should she be kicked out of society? Like, is there a way back into society if you've said something stupid on social media?
I would argue if you're saying something, then you have the right to free speech versus doing something that's violating somebody's rights like Bill Cosby did. Then I would argue that that's a completely different scenario, but I can understand why people are going to get upset on different, you know, different levels because of those different things. Like people with the Roseanne Barr, they're going to be like, well, she's racist. Clearly she should never be back because everything she's going to spew now here is racist. And you're just going to have to try to manage, or not manage, but talk to those people and be like, doesn't she have the right to an opinion, even if it's a terrible opinion? I mean, but versus somebody that's like, we can all get behind, like, yeah, rape is pretty terrible. He should probably, you know, rot in jail. And we should probably not allow somebody like that back into our society.
See, yeah, it's a very thin line. It goes back to the moral aspect of what one person considers good and what other person considers bad. Like, of course, rape, completely horrible. But I mean, like, let's say thin lines of, like, would you steal bread to feed your family? And like, some person's like, oh, yeah, of course, you're feeding family. The other person, no. And it's the, like, trying to figure out what's the moral ground. But there isn't a moral ground. There's not everybody can agree on what is considered right and wrong for everything. So it's kind of hard to determine when to shun. Like, let's say, take Reddit for example. You make one post and it's all good intention, and some people will shit on it. They will bash you and they will just tell you off regardless if you think it's right or wrong and they think it's right or wrong. It's just, yeah, it's a very, very thin line.
I had a horrible experience on this podcast, I think like 4 or 5 episodes ago. It was me, my brother, and my sister. I don't know, Alex, if you've heard of this book. It's called The Bell Curve by Charles Murray.
No, I haven't.
It was released about, I don't know, about 30 years ago. But it caused all sorts of controversy because it was arguing that, you know, IQ is tied into genetics, and people that have a higher IQ are basically getting ahead of all the other people without high IQs. And he has a short portion in it where he discusses genetic differences and IQ differences regarding race. So anyway, I and my brother and sister, we don't even get into that topic. We just were discussing the backlash behind Charles Murray because he got attacked. And I posted it on Reddit, and I knew it was going to happen. And like, people didn't even give me the benefit of the doubt. They didn't even listen to the episode. And it's funny because the episode was literally just about how difficult it is to have that conversation. But the whole 30 posts calling me a racist, like, it was the worst experience I've had on Reddit. And then it was literally like, I'm not even advocating for the book, or I'm not doing anything with the book. It was like literally just me talking about how difficult it is to even bring up the book. And people were just not having it, like, not even giving me the benefit of the doubt.
I think it just also goes to show right there, when people are, you know, they see maybe a title, what's a, like, a conversation about race, and if it doesn't immediately start out with, like, you know, racism is terrible and we can all agree on racism is terrible and that, you know, we should all be like holding hands kumbaya, if it doesn't essentially start out like that and they're not hearing something they love right off the bat, they're going to make up their entire mind about that entire podcast or article or something like that, and it's just going to be all of a sudden, boom, it's racist, it's terrible, you don't know what you're talking about, you know, what you're doing is, you know, racist, blah blah blah, racist, blah blah blah. It just goes to show people aren't going to give it the full, like you said, benefit of the doubt. They're just going to make up their minds exactly, you know, based on just a couple little brief sentences or 5 minutes of the actual hour-long podcast. So,
like, on the topic of racism, like, for me, most of it, like, I just kind of phase it out because I'm half black, half white. My wife is Korean. My brother is Russian. My brother-in-law is Russian. So, like, we have a lot of different cultures and ethnicities in our family that I just see people as people. And then, like, growing up, that was a big issue for me because the white people was black, the black people was white. But as I grow up, I'm like, you know what? This is not worth my time. People will always have opinions. So my dad gave me a good piece of advice. He said, opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one. And but what I think a big problem is that people have free speech, but people are scared to speak in the idea of what is going to be backlash. Even if you're like spreading good news, they're scared to share it because somebody out there is going to be like, oh, find something wrong about it. We live in a fear society to a certain extent.
Yeah, we have a short attention span. I would just tie it into the point. It's just, I've gotten a lot better about it, but I've trained myself to just give people the benefit of the doubt. I feel like the original point that you said, Alex, like, people are born good, and I genuinely believe that. I feel like most people have good intentions, and I'm always willing to give somebody the benefit of the doubt, right? It's just people often misspeak, and people rarely have bad intentions. So if we're a little bit better, especially on social media, to not instantly pillory somebody and, you know, go after them with burning pitchforks, right? It's like we need to slow down a bit and just give people the benefit of the doubt, realize that people have good intentions, and not just be so angry and quick all the time.
I completely agree.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, I guess it's my turn then. So I have a couple. One that's you know, definitely a hot button for a lot of people, and then one that I think is just kind of a fun, controversial opinion, just because there's not honestly a lot of science to back it up. It's just kind of a interesting one in my opinion. But my first one that I think is kind of a hot button topic is, I am a firm believer that I don't think gun-free zones should exist. And I think that the reason that so much violence tends to happen in those particular areas is because people tend to follow those rules of the gun-free zones, and they know that good law-abiding citizens who are going to see that and recognize it and follow the law, they basically just have access to, you know, victims that are essentially that are undefended. So my big thing is, I just think that if gun-free zones weren't a thing, and that, you know, and I also am a firm believer in concealed carry, and I think a lot of people should learn how to properly handle a gun and be concealed carry, and I honestly feel like that would do wonders for a lot of different shootings in these gun-free zones that are happening, it seems like, on a more and more regular basis. So that's kind of my controversial opinion. So anyway, I'll let you guys kind of chime in on that.
Yeah, for me, I'm in Canada, so we don't have as many shootings as you guys do have in the States.
Sure.
We did have one recently in Ottawa, where I'm from, in the Byward Market. So the story, what ended up happening was that a girl was walking in downtown and she was getting harassed by these group of guys. She was a teenager too. So she ended up calling her dad. Her dad rushed over from work to try to just stop it. And the guy shot the father, and the father died, unfortunately. And usually Ottawa is not known to have a lot of people with guns, and pretty much illegal to have guns in Canada, like concealed. So this, keep in mind, this is a perspective from somebody from Canada, because
actually the States and Canada, outside looking in here, so
yeah, because Canada and the States are very similar on many topics, but also different on different topics. It's always good to have different perspectives. My whole take on the concealing guns, I it's interesting because I think for me it goes beyond the guns and the point we getting to the root of why people are carrying guns. But by all means, I don't mean to offend anybody who do believe in guns. This is just my perspective, is that I think once again, we live in a society of fear where you don't necessarily trust your neighbor. So you're always protecting your loved ones and your family. And it's not just guns itself, but we're protecting ourselves by adding more security, more cameras, anything you can. Like, everything is like secure lockdown, that we don't necessarily trust each other and we're always on alert. Like, some people have hard time sleeping. They have their guns by their bedside or different places in the house. So from the Canadian perspective, I think it goes beyond. I can't speak for all Canadians. This is just me. I sound like an ambassador for Canada. Yeah. That's not what's happening.
We'll only hold your opinion to you. How about that?
Yeah, perfect, perfect.
We got NAFTA here. Canada, U.S., and then I'm from Mexico. So
there you go.
Oh, there you go. I'd love to hear your opinion after. But yeah, it's for me, I'm not big on guns. But I haven't lived in a society where guns were very present, as maybe you have, Jameson. I'm not sure. I can't speak of what your life experience was. But for me, it's back to that fear aspect, that I'm not too fond that we all are up in arms. Like, for myself, I would consider myself a very welcoming person. When I meet somebody new, I want to talk to them. I give them my trust. I'm like, you know what? Let's make this work. I want to find common ground. Mm-hmm. I don't want to come in with my hands up. So that's like where my wife and I are a little different, where when we first started a relationship, I was the type like, I'm giving you all my trust. And throughout time, if you break it, that's where it goes down. But for her, it was the other way around. She doesn't start off with a lot of trust, but as we stay longer together, that's how the trust builds.
Sure.
So it's kind of like those two different perspectives. Yeah.
No. And like I said, I love the outside looking in perspective. Yeah, so that's great. And I agree with you. A lot of it is the fact that people do live in like that fear society and that they don't trust their neighbor and stuff like that. But I mean, my big thing is like, obviously, if somebody comes into my house, you know, mm-hmm. I own a gun, I feel like at that point, perfectly legal to go ahead and protect myself. But the whole aspect of like I was talking about in like a gun-free zone, like banks, schools, things like that, where a lot of these shootings tend to happen, I just am a firm believer that I feel like if these weren't gun-free zones, and that if people felt like that if they go into these areas and somebody's going to start shooting back at them, that they're not going to start going into these shootings in the first place. Or that if they are, you know, we might be looking at a body count of maybe that was once going to be 20 versus now maybe 5, which is once again the argument for the greater good. But that's just kind of my personal opinion. Like I said, I do feel like it's a very controversial opinion that a lot of people have a lot of backlash on because it's a very hot button issue. But yeah, like I said, I like your perspective, and it's good to have that somebody, that fresh eyes, that fresh blood to the story, if you will. So, mm-hmm. Jerry?
Yeah, I don't want to deviate too much from your point, Jameson. I think, so I'm not a gun owner. I don't have a problem with guns. I really don't. I guess there's a lot of topics to talk on. One is safety is obviously a powerful motivator for people. Sure. But safety, I don't think so. Two things. One, we're in the safest time we've ever been in human history. Violence is at an all-time low. There's the fewest amount of wars that have ever happened, right? We're literally at the safest time ever. And then if you want to talk about gun and gun violence, especially here in the United States, most of it is related to inner cities like Chicago, New York, New Orleans, I want to say,
yeah.
Los Angeles. Yeah. So it's very concentrated. And a lot of that, so I feel like the gun-free zones and things like that are a bit of red herrings when people are talking about safety, right? It's just gun-free zones, yeah, they can give people the illusion of safety or even just a real sense of safety, right? It's a reality that if somebody has a gun and is about to commit a mass murder, somebody with a gun is going to be able to stop them a lot faster. So yeah, just, I don't know. I can see why guns are the problem, but I think it also makes sense to have somebody with a gun if somebody's about to commit a mass shooting, right? So I don't know. I guess agnostic on guns.
I like that. Actually, I was thinking as well, for let's say if you were to come visit Canada, would you bring keep the same like mentality as you would back home? And if a Canadian were to visit the States, should they keep the same mentality as they have from their home? Or should they like adapt to the mentality of where they're visiting?
That's a great question, because I'm a firm believer that if you go to another country, you are a guest in that country, and then you abide by their rules, you abide by their customs, you abide by their different things. Granted, I'm not going to go and travel to North Korea, for example, you know, or a place like Saudi Arabia or, you know, Syria or something like that with an extremely high, you know, violence rate. But if I'm going to be traveling to Canada or, and I do travel actually quite a bit. I've been to Europe several different times, been to Central America, Mexico, things like that. And every time that we've gone, I've been very, very aware that I'm in another country and that I have to abide to their rules and that I have to essentially abide to their customs and things like that. So I think it's important for people to realize, you know, like when you do travel, that you are one, traveling for an educational experience, and you're two, you aren't going to be having the same comforts that you have at home. So you are going to be taking a little bit of a higher risk in that aspect. Just like I feel like it's same if people travel to the United States. I'm like, hey, you are traveling to the United States now. You know, you are, you know, we're not going to bend to your customs. You're going to be bending to ours. Granted, you could probably find, you know, in the United States, a place with a lot of your customs because we are that big melting pot. But still, it's kind of the mentality I think people should take.
So let's say if you were to give me one big piece of advice as a Canadian who, sorry, hit the mic, as a Canadian visiting the United States, I'm sure every different state has different principles and different mentality, state of mind. What would be like a good piece of advice you would give to, let's say, the general Canadian visiting the general United States of America?
Whew, that is a great question.
that's a deep question, yeah. I know.
Heart attack burger.
Is that a piece of advice or just a statement?
Just saying that's what you're going to have after you have a burger. No, I would say that with the United States, one thing that in my experience with traveling the world, people definitely have a persona about the United States as people individually, like, you know, a lot of people picture Texas or California, you know, Texas are like, wow, everything's bigger in Texas. And, you know, California, it's like a bunch of tree loving hippies type thing. But when they actually meet a lot of people from the United States, they realize, you know, they're just people. And that we're actually like the biggest thing that I found is that a lot of people say like people from the United States are a lot nicer than what we expected. So, for example, when I went to I think it was France or Belgium, one of those two, we went to a restaurant and the waiter there was kind of taken aback because it was as we went, I went on a church mission trip. So we were in kind of like a remote area of Belgium. So yeah, I think it was Belgium. We went to this restaurant and he had very, very few encounters with people from the United States. And he was just very taken aback, you know, our pleases, our thank yous or things like that. And just kind of courtesies and just being very conscious of trying to, you know, make sure he's, you know, because there was a language barrier, so we were trying to be very conscious of making sure that he understood what we were saying, we understood what he was saying, and he was just very taken aback at our patience with him and things like that. And then a lot of people that I've talked to that have traveled to the United States and, you know, for different, you know, school or whatever reasons, they're just very taken aback that the people in the United States are much friendlier than our reputation actually perceives us to be.
And you know what sucks? It's always the few that ruin it for the many.
True. Very true.
That's, amen.
Yeah. So thanks, Texas and California.
Well, no, I'm sure there's people are very friendly, but of course they won't get the attention or the media spotlight as the ones that are louder and the ones that don't deserve the spotlight, I guess.
The vocal minority, if you will.
Yeah. Let's go with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, yeah, that is a good. Yeah, it's a good question. It was one I had to think about there for a while, so I liked it. But yeah, so I guess my other controversial topic, and like I said, it's kind of more of like a silly, fun one. It's just something that I have kind of thought upon for the last couple of years as a bit of a hobby horse. I think humans as a species are actually not the first advanced species to ever actually walk on the face of the earth. And I'm not saying like you know, advanced, like as advanced as we are today, having podcasts, internet, things like that. I think, you know, we can, I can argue that at least they've got to, you know, Bronze Age maybe, or, you know, maybe at least the Stone Age. But I just feel like with, you know, at least multicellular advancements since the Cambrian explosion of over 500, almost 600 million years ago, and that there's been over 5 mass extinctions in Earth's history that we know about, I just am a firm believer that I feel like some species on this planet got to an advanced state, and that, you know, some kind of either an apocalypse or disease or something happened and basically wiped it out, and we kind of had a whole, you know, do-over type thing. And I feel like, you know, said over the course of history, there's probably been a couple of different times that species have gotten pretty advanced. Like I said, it's just kind of a fun one. A lot of scientists will be like, no, that's impossible. But it's, yeah, and like I said, there's not a ton of science to back it up, but it's just kind of an interesting controversial opinion, I think. And some people, I think, never even thought of that, so...
That's an interesting thing you mentioned. I don't want to go too much off your topic, but it's like the same idea where, is there life form on other planets? Are they more advanced more advanced than us? Yeah, I've never actually thought of if there was an advanced life form on Earth way before us. You know what? I feel like, because I can't remember specifically, but like there was Neanderthals and other different types of primates, mm-hmm. and mammals that some went extinct, some survived, pretty much the humans,
right?
I can't remember what was the right term, but that's an interesting concept, because I didn't think too much of that further than what you just said now. But now I'm thinking, you know what, there's a high possibility, because scientists and paleontologists and other people are discovering new things every single day or every single week or month. I don't know the precise discovery rate, but they learn something new, and I don't doubt there's a possibility that maybe something drastic, like just annihilated all, let's say, bones and stuff like that of a population. There's a possibility that they didn't like dominate the entire Earth, but maybe a small like colony or a little area, and that unfortunately got wiped out.
Yeah,
I wouldn't discount it. I don't know. I'd be highly skeptical, because we're people, or at least organisms, especially organisms. They're messy. That organized organisms are messy, so we would leave a trace of something, right? We would something would be out of order, like if we figured out farming, or if we figured out some kind of pottery or Bronze Age material. So I mean, I don't discount it, and I love the notion as a counterfactual, because it forces you to think. So many people are so quick to discount the idea, and if you really think about it, it kind of forces you to think about how you know what you know. Like, how do you know that human or Homo sapiens were the first intelligent species? Like, how in fact do you really know that, right? And most people kind of pause and are like, oh crap, I don't really know that. I've just been told that. And it's a great mental exercise, even if it's, like you said, Jameson, like there's no really science to back it up. It through why you know or what you know, right? It's just you for the first time have to explain to somebody what you know and what you think.
Yeah, and there's a couple of different reasons that I kind of came to this conclusion. I read an article, it was a few years back, I can't remember exactly who wrote it and where I found it, but it talked about that, basically kind of that whole, you know, life has existed for so long on this planet, and that, you know, we really have only been able to go beneath the surface, I think they said, about of our history of about 2 million years or so, and that they can only really kind of have very accurate records as far as that far back. And of course, with plate tectonics moving, weather erosion, all these different things, asteroids hitting, you know, you name it, volcanoes erupting, all these different things, there's ways that essentially could have wiped out the evidence. And, you know, if something happened 100 million years ago, that's a long time for something to essentially, you know, get all of its evidence erased and things like that. So it's kind of like what you said, it made me think to challenge, I know what I actually know type thing. And that's kind of why I liked it, because it basically opened me up to some new ideas. And then the other thing was a very cheesy way that got me thinking about this is Battlestar Galactica. I've been thinking about this because the very, and I apologize, it's a spoiler here for anybody that hasn't seen it. But the very end of it...
Earmuffs.
Yeah, earmuffs. But the very end of it, actually, you're kind of taken aback because all of a sudden... You think that when they were talking about their original planet, they're like, you know, we came from this planet called Earth, blah, blah, blah. You're thinking Earth, but what it actually is that they come to Earth as we know it today, and they're actually the start of life, how it exists, and they're actually, like, the first evidence of mitochondrial Eve and stuff like that. And it just kind of blows your mind. You're like, whoa, maybe we were kind of planted, and maybe, you know, a couple hundred thousand years ago, there was another advanced life on Earth here that started here and kind of gave us the... you know, the genetic just jump that we needed, which was pretty interesting thought. So
actually on that, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say on that note, so we were talking about the past. Do you think if, let's say, humankind or the human race were to be extinct, would there be another life, intelligent life form on Earth?
I do. Just because, like I said, there's been 5 mass extinctions on Earth that we know of. And life has, like I said, Jeff Goldblum said, life has found a way. And I think that it's kind of one of those inevitable things that, you know, when humans die out for whatever reason, you know, whether it be an asteroid hits us, another plague comes about, you know, we run out of resources, global warming, climate change, whatever it may be. I do think, honestly, you know, 500 million years from now, we could be looking at there's another advanced civilization that's, you know, finding our remnants on the moon of a flag that we planted up there, you know, who knows? So I do think it's a very strong possibility.
And do you think history would repeat itself, or they would learn from whatever they find from our past?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think it's a fair argument to say that all this has happened before and all this has happened again, mm-hmm. will happen again type thing.
That's the Fermi paradox, isn't it?
Kind of is, yeah.
So the Fermi, for people that aren't aware, is a kind of by the physicist, I forgot his first name, but anyway, he's a physicist, and he posited that civilizations go through different stages. So there's the first intelligence one, and then there's like a stage 2, stage 3, stage 4 is like an intergalactic civilization, and in order to cross through that, right, you have to survive your apocalyptic events. And one of the reasons why we haven't seen intelligent life is, one is the possibility that civilizations haven't crossed that barrier, or they've all met their extinction event,
or that we're the first.
Yeah, exactly. Or that we're the first.
So do you guys think we're close to the extinction phase, or the next?
I think it's
go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think one of the possibilities is artificial intelligence, and we're creating an intelligence that's working at the speed of light, and it's going to be, so for example, the smartest human probably took a mathematician, right? He's probably more intelligent than all of us and was one of the smartest humans, but artificial intelligence is just going to be exponentially smarter than anything John von Neumann could conjure up. So one of the extinction events, a very real possibility, is that we merge ourselves with an artificial intelligence, right? We kind of figure out a way to not be surpassed by them. So that could be a possibility here in the next few hundred years or so.
Are you for that or against it?
I don't know. I'm afraid of it. I think one would be truly frightening is if intelligence, like artificial intelligence, wasn't aware that it was intelligent, right? And consciousness just kind of disappeared from the universe. That would be truly terrifying, right? We would want the universe to still be aware of itself, right? We're kind of gifted with consciousness. We're aware that we're part of the universe. So that, as long as we don't lose sight of that, or as long as we don't lose our consciousness or the ability to realize that we're here, then I don't see any problem with merging with it, right? But that would be truly terrifying and kind of sad, really, because then there's just the universe just existing without really any sense.
It'd also be a loss of all the history and all the sacrifice that's been made throughout the years to get up to that point as well.
Yeah, exactly.
We truly do live in a very interesting time in the human history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very much so. I'd like to think that we're not on the brink of an apocalypse type situation, but I mean, it's hard to it's hard to discredit the fact that there's so many threats that are there, like Yellowstone exploding. I mean, it seems like every time you turn around that there's some kind of tension between some countries that do have nuclear weapons that, you know, if they launched it, you know, we could be looking at, you know, nuclear winter, things like that. Obviously, threats of climate change are always present, and you know, always we can monitor the skies as much as we want, but we never know if like another asteroid that took out the dinosaurs is going to take out us in the next, you know, week or so. But I don't know. I'd like to think that we're smart enough as a species that we are going to find a way to basically have our species continue, whether it be on this planet or if we look at expanding out into the universe and start colonizing other planets and things like that. I do think that that won't obviously happen in our lifetime, but, you know, maybe grandchildren's type lifetime, I think, is a possibility.
And that's the great thing about not just humans, but pretty much every living organism on Earth. We adapt. We want to survive. Your body, whether you want to, like, you're feeling sick, your body's fighting to survive. Everything is trying to survive. So if we face something, we're going to try to find a way to adapt and thrive, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, that's true. It's amazing where life can't grow.
It's true.
Like, I mean, in the deepest oceans, in the most acid riddled sulfuric plumes are just emanating from the ground, and there's life down there. It's amazing.
And then you find life that just, like he said, is very resilient, like the tardigrass or whatever it is. That little thing just won't die.
Tardigrade.
Yeah, the tardigrade. It won't die. It's like, oh, you want to throw me in the vacuum of space? No big deal. I'll live.
I love space.
Yeah. You want to dehydrate
me? My summer vacation home.
Yeah. You want to put me in the pressure chamber of the ocean? Do it. Yeah. I'm just not going to die.
I call that bench pressing. I can do this. Put more pressure.
Yeah. Come on. Just one more. Come on. Yeah. They're awesome little critters, but like you said, they don't want to die, and it's just, that's life finding a way to live right there.
Well, it's like frogs, for example. You could freeze them and then unfreeze them, and then they're okay. Like, they were trying to figure that out for Walt Disney, like, in the same technology.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. Jeez, I didn't know you could freeze frogs and then unfreeze them. That's crazy.
I think there's also a jellyfish called the immortal jellyfish, where itself continuously just regenerates, which is crazy. And I also think lobsters continue to grow, and I could be wrong, but they don't die unless they suffer something, right?
Is that right? Like, or immune to cancer or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're thinking of elves from Lord of the Rings.
Elves are immune to cancer or not dying?
Yeah.
Both. Yeah. Although if they take a sword to the head from an orc, not so pretty.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was a great podcast, guys.
Yeah, I loved it. This is like the first time I had like this type of conversation where it got really deep, really dark, but in a good way.
Yeah.
But it just flowed so well.
Well, if you ever want to be a guest on our podcast again, Alex, you are more than welcome. So.
Hey, just whenever you need a guest, like a pop-up guest where crazy bald-headed guy needs to talk for an hour and a half, I'm your man.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. And then if you want one more time, do a little plug for your podcast with your website, contact information, things like that.
So, yeah, once again, my podcast is called Time for Your Hobby, and you can find it on Spotify. I was going to say Twitch. No. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts. And I'm trying to find, just give me half a second, for Jameson's episode, because I think it was episode 28.
Could be wrong. Sounds right. Yes.
Okay, so his episode was about podcasting, so you could definitely go check him out. So my format of podcasting is a little different from them. It's a little more structured. Theirs is more like spiritual, and like you get into like deep conversations. You hear my voice peaking high, peaking low, and it's I love the experience. But for mine, you get into a depth of learning more about Jameson. You get to learn everything from him, and I mean everything.
Every single detail. All of them. Every single
thing you don't even want to know about it, you're going to learn about it.
I held nothing back.
Yeah, but also if you like, if you want to be on my podcast, you can send me an email at timeforyourhobby@gmail.com. And you know what? This was such an amazing experience. I want to thank both of you so much for doing it, for letting me be on your podcast.
Absolutely, man. And like definitely come back. Yeah, we loved having you on.
So, I'll be there.
Perfect. Well, Jerry, do you have any final thoughts?
No, that was great.
Yeah, that was really good. And then once again to our listeners, our website is theowlpodcast@fireside.fm, and our Twitter handle is owl_podcast, and our Gmail is theowlpodcast@gmail.com. So thanks for being offended with us.